Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Some of them are smiling. You know, they're quite proud. Hey, you know, I made it through training. I am in the U.S. Army Air Force. And they were the rock stars of the 1940s, quite frankly. It's a 21st century way of thinking of these guys and how they viewed themselves.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone. The 390th Memorial Museum is a museum within a museum at the Pima Air and Space Museum. It is a museum dedicated to the memory and service of the men of the 390th Bomb Group that flew their missions in the 8th Air Force out of RAF Framlingham in Suffolk. It is a remarkable museum and one that I was profoundly moved in, and we're going to get into that a bit with the museum's executive director, Bill Buckingham. When I was at the Pima Air and Space Museum back in February, Bill was kind enough to spend an hour or so with me to discuss how the museum came about and also talk about the men of the 390th and what it means to him to be able to tell their story to all the visitors who come and visit, not just the incredibly beautifully restored B-17 that they have, but also the incredible photographs and jackets from the men of the 390th. So, first question to Bill, how did the museum come about?
So during World War II, especially during the first several years of the war, there was no way to take the fight directly to Hitler except through the skies. And once America entered the war and started building aircraft and training crews, and started shipping over to England and using that beautiful island as a very stable aircraft carrier to strike at Nazi Germany and its web of units across all of Western Europe. The 390th was a bomb group within what was called the U.S. 8th Air Force, which was a unit of the American Army Air Force, specifically designed to bomb military targets in Europe. And the 390th was comprised of about 3,000 individuals. It consisted of pilots and co-pilots and others on the aircraft, and thousands of men and a few women on the ground that it did everything from issuing paychecks and making sure the mail got delivered to repairing the aircraft, arming the aircraft, safely loading bombs on the aircraft, cooking for the ground crews and the air crews, et cetera. It's basically a whole little small village, small city, really. Had the equivalent of a police department, had a hospital. So you had everything that you would see, had religious services, so chaplains, rabbis, everything you would see in a small, self-sufficient city comprised the 390th Bomb Group. And they were part of a much larger organization dedicated to taking the war to Hitler and its cronies out of England. Of course, post-victory, the Allies win the war in Europe. Everyone's eager to return to civilian life. So in the 1970s, the former commanding officer of this bomb group...
Before we jump forward,
yeah.
Where were they based?
A tiny little area, East Anglia, East England, Framlingham. Little village, had a church, had a pub, had a few houses, and a railroad going through it, and one small road.
And then a whopping great airbase.
and this enormous airbase. The population of the airbase greatly outnumbered the population of the village, probably by certainly 50 to 1, maybe 100 to 1, something on that scale. Former farmland, former RAF base, turned over to the Americans to launch airstrikes against the Nazi regime. So the commanding officer, Colonel Joe Mahler, must have made one heck of an impression on the men at that base, the flight crews and the ground crews, because in the late 70s, he starts developing this concept of building some kind of a memorial to those who served in the 390th and, of course, those who were lost during their service in the 390th. So he starts calling men and women who were ordered to potentially die at his command that are scattered across the United States. And rather than hanging up on them, I think something that many vets would have done, they took his call and ultimately were recruited into this effort to build some kind of a memorial. And the idea of the memorial kind of grew, expanded into the idea of a memorial museum, some sort of a museum, originally located on Davis-Monthan Air Base. So not the most publicly accessible memorial. So Mahler approached the great Pima Air and Space Museum and worked out an arrangement where we could build our own separate museum on Pima Air and Space Museum grounds, our own separate nonprofit, our own separate governance and fundraising and whatnot, and secured that arrangement and went to the Air Force, and they were able to secure a B-17 that was in service as a firefighting aircraft at the time on loan to the Forest Service. So Colonel Mahler goes to the Air Force. The Air Force goes back to the Forest Service. That's want our aircraft back. So plane arrives, flies into Davis-Monthan and is rolled across the street. And these veterans begin this campaign of scouring the United States and perhaps further afield to secure all the parts and pieces to equip the bomber as it would have been during World War II. Because all of that stuff had been stripped off. Its purpose was to dump fire retardant on burning forests. So bomb racks, machine guns, sights, the radio equipment, navigational equipment, all the turrets, the fixtures that you would have seen in England at the 390th base, long since gone. Everything. And paint it and clean it up and equip it just like you would have seen on its base in England, which in itself was an amazing undertaking, but they went above and beyond that. They continued to reach out to 390th ground crew and air crew veterans who began donating everything from love letters written to and from their spouses and or girlfriends back in the States or in England, to diaries, photographs, flight gear, flight suits, flight jackets, gloves, hats, ties, shirts, shoelaces, radios, everything, flare guns, everything that they had kind of packed away in their closets as they went about their civilian lives, putting the war behind them, for trying to forget the heinous things that they witnessed or experienced, and started building up a really impressive collection of flight tower logs. Mm-hmm. We have tens of thousands of pages of documents from the base, from the control tower, from the headquarters. We know the crew assignments, what day they flew, what they were carrying, who flew in each individual plane, the success or failures over the target, the losses, etc., transfers, who got paid what, you name it. We've got this incredibly detailed history of the 390th preserved in artifacts and documents and photographs, as well as in the form of the aircraft and other artifacts that are on display.
So it's an incredibly granular amount of detail you have about the life of the base.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very personalized exploration. Matter of fact, one of the things we have that we were talking about earlier, we have hundreds of crew photos. The crew photos are photos of generally all 10 of the flight crew posing oftentimes in front of their personalized aircraft or maybe an aircraft that they flew just during training. But they were trained as a unit, went over as a unit, and more often than not, flew as a cohesive unit of 10 guys whose ultimate authority rested in the pilot. His responsibility was for those other 9 lives, co-pilot, navigator, bombardier, the gunners, and so forth. So we have these photos of faces looking back at you here in the 21st century of very young guys, many of them scared but hiding it well, scared to death, posing as a group before their flights. And about 2/3 of those guys were either killed or shot down and became prisoner, may have died as a prisoner of war, looking back at you. Some of the crew photos have their dogs. And one crew photo, if you look very carefully, column 28 in this mural exhibit, shows the baby bear that went over from the United States with this bomb group. The flight engineer made a specialized oxygen mask for the bear so he could survive the high-altitude flight across the Atlantic. He didn't go up on many missions. He stayed on the ground most of the time. But you see these guys proudly posing with their pet bear. I mean, this isn't a museum that's about hardware so much as it is about the people, their experiences with life and death, their service, their time in England. For the flight crews, that time was limited. Maybe they go up on one mission, get shot down. Their time is ended. Maybe they fly all require 25, 30, 35 missions. They rotate back to a safer duty elsewhere. But the guys who had to patch them up or bury them, the guys who had to remove the remains from the aircraft and turn that aircraft around, repair its battle damage so it could go up perhaps the very next day, they were stuck there for the duration. So they served and suffered in a very different kind of way.
So the ground crews didn't have a specified tour. They were assigned to the base and they were there.
Oh, okay. Indeed. My dad was a ground crew in the 6th Air Force in Panama. His brother was 8th Air Force. He was crew chief in England, not with the 390th. So I grew up hearing these stories, seeing the photos. So these guys suffered in a different way than the flight crew, but they paid a price nevertheless. And that's what we present. We present these stories of life on the base, service and sacrifice. Yes, we are focused on the 390th Bomb Group, but the experiences of these young kids at all the other bases was incredibly similar. So it's also a window onto a much broader story that we also tell.
Using the 390th to tell the 8th story.
Really. Exactly.
And you mentioned the photographs. If I'm honest, I walked up to the upper level to have a better look at the aircraft, which is stunning. I didn't spend much time looking at the aircraft. It's incredibly moving. It's very well done. It gets a bit overwhelming because there's so many young faces looking back at you.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I sort of went up from the backside and walked away round to where you've got the jackets and things. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, it's so well done. You don't look at the beautiful shiny B-17 that's on the ground floor, right. And it's incredibly moving. So it has the desired effect, or it certainly did on me.
I've been director since last July, and I still tear up if I spend much time looking at these photos. It's interesting to look. Some of them are smiling. You know, they're quite proud. Hey, you know, I made it through training. I am in the U.S. Army Air Force. And they were the rock stars of the 1940s, quite frankly, is a 21st century way of thinking of these guys and how they viewed themselves. And, of course, being in their late teens or very early 20s, the notion of death,
you're and mortality. You're awesome with that, aren't you?
Yeah, you're invincible. And even after they got to their base and flew their first mission or saw others coming back from their mission, in their minds, it's always the other guy.
Yeah.
He's going to go down in a fireball, not me. And, of course, two-thirds of those faces staring back from that epoch in time, looking at you today, were either killed, wounded, or in prison. Only about a third came home relatively unscathed, physically relatively unscathed. Of course, psychologically and emotionally, they paid a huge toll because this was carnage on a scale unimaginable to kids growing up in the United States, maybe from small towns or farms during the Great Depression. Nothing could prepare them for what they would see or personally experience once they got to England and participate in the greatest air war ever. And hopefully there will never be something on that scale again.
Goodness, no, let's hope not. What is you've been in post for a while now? What's the sort of general feeling to it? Because the eighth sort of lives large, doesn't it?
It does.
Even now, I'm a B-25 guy. The 14th and those guys over there. Kind of when you research them, read out, the eighth is they're stealing focus a lot of the time.
Sure.
But why does the eighth stay in our view so much now?
Very good questions. Part of it comes down to where American reporters were stationed. Many of them, were stationed at or near 8th Air Force bases. So you had the cameras, you had the reporters, you had the correspondents telling the stories repeatedly back home on the radio and the newspapers and the periodic magazines of the time. Of course, there were no television stations during this period of time. So they got the coverage, and that echoed down through time. But it goes beyond just where the reporters were stationed. That's, I think, part of it. Part of it was they were a very, very large outfit that, from their creation, starting with a half a dozen guys, by midpoint of the war, had swelled to an organization over 200,000. 200,000, and they were a functioning organization. If you imagine trying to form, let's say, a restaurant chain from 6 people to 200,000 people with that kind of global reach and complex machinery and stuff in a matter of some number of months. It's hard to conceive here in the 21st century of anything like that. And yet they did that. So logistically, organizationally, management-wise, leadership-wise, there were thousands of miracles involved and lots of hard work in just simply creating it and making it work, yet alone going from peacetime and making it work in a horrific combat environment where everything was trying to kill you, not just the Germans. Mother Nature was trying to kill these guys because they were going up in aircraft hastily designed, hastily built, that were flying at 6 miles above the surface of the Earth, 50 to 60 below zero. The first generation of B-17s over there didn't even have window glass in the radio and waste compartment. So you had 120 to 160 mile an hour winds cutting through the aircraft, which was unpressurized, unheated. Other than a small number of pilots today, most people listening to the broadcast have never experienced flight in this kind of manner, where you have to have multiple layers of clothing on you or you will freeze in a very small number of minutes in an unpressurized aircraft, where if you take your oxygen mask off for a small number of minutes, you will go unconscious. A few minutes beyond that, you are brain dead. So the environment was trying to kill these young kids, as well as the Germans. The clouds, the fog. You know, these guys trained in the United States, where? Mostly in clear, sunny Western states, right? The English environment, much of the year, was very, very, very different than what they trained in here in the United States.
The weather's still trying to kill us.
Yes. and the technique, the model of operating was hazardous as well, trying to take initially a few hundred and then later in the war a few thousand aircraft from dispersed bases all over eastern England to go up to their assigned altitude, 30,000 feet, and to maneuver into assigned positions, flying essentially wingtip to wingtip, in the fog, in the sleet, in the snow, in the rain, and everything else, all the other joyous aspects of the English flying weather, and just getting into formation was an extremely hazardous undertaking that many didn't survive. Mid-air collisions, others never found their assigned formation, went off into the muck, ran out of fuel somewhere over the Atlantic, never seen or heard from again. So every aspect of what they were undertaking was extremely hazardous to their health and their longevity. So the dramatic story that I just described, all of these elements working against them, and yet these thousands of young kids persevered. They went on their missions. They fought their way through the German fighters, the German cannons on the ground. They were never turned back by anything other than Mother Nature. They would sometimes get recall orders after having fought their way through the initial defenses of the Third Reich, get a recall order and turn around. But they were never recalled because of the Germans. Never. They were recalled, if at all, because of Mother Nature not cooperating, usually over the target. Back then, if you couldn't see the target, you couldn't hit it. There was radar was in a very primitive state, at least radar that could be carried on an aircraft. The British, of course, famously used radar to defend the island. But you had the luxury of really big sets of electronics on the ground. You didn't have to have them small enough to fit into an airplane and light enough for the airplane to take off. So just so many elements of the 8th Air Force story to capture the imagination. And unfortunately, part of their notoriety comes from the horrendous casualties that they suffered. You were safer being in the U.S. Marines than you were the 8th Air Force. Safer in the U.S. Navy. Safer being in the U.S. Army than you were in the 8th Air Force.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we are at the Pima Air and Space Museum with some of our Korean War vintage aircraft. Here is our F-86E Sabre, which was the preeminent American jet fighter during the Korean conflict. Originally, we were flying a lot of straight-wing aircraft like the F-84 and, you know, reciprocating engine aircraft still like the Mustang, various other aircraft. When this aircraft made its debut, the MiG-15, which was used by the North Koreans, with also probably some help from other nations. But it was a game changer, swept wings, had cannon, and really, you know, overpowered anything with a straight wing. Around that time, our F-86 started coming into Korea, which the two aircraft were pretty equally matched. Armament aside, you know, the F-86 had 50 calibers, while the MiG had, I believe, 20-millimeter cannons, if I recall correctly. Three?
30-millimeter, I think it was.
Was it 30-millimeter?
Two 30, 220, something like that, yeah.
Okay. Cannon. Not the armaments. They're cannons versus machine guns, which has always been a big argument. You know, the Americans were always full in on the 50 cal and the machine gun side of things, while a lot of other nations tended to lean towards cannons. You know, so depends who you ask which is the better aerial weapon. But our F-86 is actually a real combat veteran. It flew with the 51st Fighter Interceptor Wing. It's a bit of a Franken airplane. The fuselage did come from a Korean War veteran. The wings did come from another aircraft, but that was one of those things where we decided to go with, obviously, the identity of the fuselage, which, you know, has the more interesting history and has an actual Korean War combat provenance. It could be a little bit of a time, too, to talk about our curatorial choices with paint schemes.
Yes.
Usually we always try to paint our aircraft in markings that are historically accurate for that aircraft. This F-86 is an example of this. The markings on the aircraft are based on photographic evidence from the Korean War of this aircraft. Our MiG-15, on the other hand, like most surviving MiGs in a lot of collections, is a Polish MiG. It's not a Korean MiG. But because for this, we decided we wanted to tell the story of the Korean War, so we did paint this aircraft in North Korean markings, where usually we don't do that. We usually always try to paint the aircraft for, you know, the historically accurate markings for that aircraft. But like I said, once in a while, when we have another story to tell, we'll make an exception. Also, if we painted all our MiGs, they would all be pretty much in Polish markings instead of representing some of the different Warsaw Pact nations like we have.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And now, back to the show. Let's get back to the 390th. We've done the big picture. What, through the collation of all of that, you know, first-hand primary documentation, what are some of the stories that have sort of leapt out of you as your time here at the museum? That, because you know, as you walk around, there's lots of individual little notes. There's I can't remember the navigator's name, but there's the page from his notebook right. as well, which. It's just bringing a really clear human focus yes. on this, because it can be a little bit overwhelming when you've got a big airplane, there's all those photos right. and things, but you draw into this. For you, as the boss, what's leapt out at you?
Number of things. Right now, the exhibits on the main level that are in the recessed display cases. Those are all temporary exhibits. The main exhibits ordinarily are there, had to be removed when we suffered significant rain damage, water intrusion from the roof a couple summers ago. So we are in a rebuilding phase. But
prior to that, listener, it does rain here in Arizona.
Oh, it does. And when it does, sometimes it's 3, 4, 5 inches all in a matter of an hour or two. So when the skies let loose in Arizona, they really let loose and sometimes comes through a museum roof and does exhibit damage. So what you're seeing is a small fraction of what's on display, what will be coming back on display. One of the things that touched me is the guys carried these little paper pamphlets, maybe 3 inches across, 4 inches tall, maybe smaller than that. These were their pay books. They got paid once a month. And we will be returning to exhibit this one officer's pay book. And to see both, even in 1940s terms and certainly in 21st century terms, the $200 a month that an officer going into combat on one of these aircraft would get paid, and his life insurance deduction, and how much of it was being withheld by the U.S. Department of War, the War Department, and being sent back to his family. And the small number of dollars he kept for himself there that he had to buy extra uniforms with. If he went off base for food or alcohol or whatever, small number of dollars he lived on for such an incredibly hazardous job. And he was a pilot. The pay books for the enlisted guys, the gunners, who were in that plane suffering the same hazards as the pilot in the cockpit, so much less. For me, that makes it very personal, as well as the diaries, the log books from the different stations that we have. Really, when you see it in their own handwriting, letters home, letters from home, the kinds of things that they thought of or worried about are the things that we worry about today, but amplified by the loneliness, the isolation. Even though they were in a base of 3,000 men and a few women, they were still so isolated in many ways, physically, emotionally. They were ultimately with strangers. They weren't with their family. They weren't with people they grew up with. So there was a sense of isolation, even in a crowded officer's club or NCO club. Might be packed shoulder to shoulder on a day where a mission was scrubbed so they could consume beer and whatever else could be made available on base or off base. They were still very alone in many ways, still missing home. After all, many of these guys were teenagers. It's phenomenal the number of guys who forged their papers or faked the signatures to get into the war because they were too young to be accepted by the War Department. This was an American endeavor that these young kids were trying really hard to get into. They wanted to be part of the Army Air Forces. They wanted to defend democracy, defend freedom, to take the fight to this Austrian corporal in Berlin. Just so different a phenomenon than what I grew up observing. Disclaimer of my age, I grew up watching the Vietnam conflict unfold and collapse, to watch individuals trying to avoid service in that conflict. So that was my generational experience. So looking back with that experience to an epoch in time where people wanted to get involved, wanted to serve, wanted to take the fight to Hitler, also is quite moving for me.
What sort of reaction do you have? Because I spent a bit of time wandering around yesterday having a look, and I like watching other people in museums and seeing how they interact with the space, how they interact with the exhibits. It was noticeable that, as I was saying, it's very moving, and a couple of people had the same idea as me. Oh, let's go up and have another look. And I heard them coming up the stairs having that conversation, and then again they were drawn into the photographs. What's the sort of reaction people have as they go through the museum? Because this is quite an overwhelming place at the best time. There's a lot of aircraft. There's a lot to see.
Yes.
But the 3/9 Museum is very intimate. What sort of reactions do you see from the people that come through the door?
Tech heads, the guys and the gals that come in who are interested in the machinery will stand and have all sorts of detailed conversations with my staff and my volunteers, my docents. So there's that crowd. But there's a very large crowd of people who come into our museum, perhaps even by accident, didn't know we were here at Pima Air and Space Museum. Come in, not really sure what we're about, get up, maybe a 2-minute intro by my docents in the lobby and start exploring. Many people look at the airplane, stick their head in the various hatches that are open, and the plane is well lit so you can see what turns out to be a pretty confined space for a plane that looks so big on the outside.
It's a lot smaller than they show in the movies.
You betcha. This is especially in the forward half of the airplane, that nose, you got around on your belly to go from the nose to the flight deck, for example, and trying to squeeze through the bomb bay in the center of the plane was also a very tight fit. So it's a tight space, and people wonder about that. But what's really interesting to watch are when people encounter the flight jackets. This is not just a uniform. This is a piece of leather clothing that a very young guy, a very skinny young guy wore in combat, many times decorated personally. They may have names of their sweethearts or their moms inscribed on the jacket, artwork on the back and perhaps the front, the patches or icons that they added to the jackets. These were, unique individuals. This wasn't just some nameless, faceless mass of soldiers. These were individual airmen with individual personal interests, passions, and fears, many times illustrated on their jackets. The jackets that may have the bomb symbols painted on it. That was a countdown to safety. Once they got their 25 bombs painted on the jacket, they could escape the horrors of the European air war and go somewhere safer, go back to a training base in the U.S. or get a desk job at a base. So those tick marks are not just marks of pride, but a countdown to escape, to safety, to be able to maybe go home to their girlfriends, their wives, their moms, their dads, their siblings, or their children back home. So to watch visitors look at these jackets and watch that story sink in is, for me, very profound. The other really profound thing, we get a lot of families who are coming to the museum that knew that their grandpa, their dad, their uncle, some relative, was in the Air Force during World War II. I think he was in England. And we can look up that information in the lobby. And if they were with the 390th, we can direct them to the photo of their uncle, their dad, their grandpa, their crew photo on the wall. And to watch the emotional reactions. This may be
the first time they saw a photo of their dad or their grandpa when he was 19. And, you know, dad was just this middle-aged guy that, you know, told them when to be home for supper and made sure they did their homework. And now they're seeing him, you know, maybe 17, 18, 19, with these other guys proudly in their flight suits, maybe by the aircraft they were assigned to. And a lot of them start crying.
I can totally see that. And how reward, I don't know if rewarding is the right way, humbling that must be for you as the museum director to be able to enable that connection must be something.
Is my experience prior to coming to this museum at observatories and NASA museums, so much of that was displaying either exploration technology, mm-hmm. and telescopes are a form of exploration technology, rocket ships, robotic space probes, the Hubble Space Telescope and such, or presenting really big concepts of space and time and distance and the power of black holes or the possibility of life on other worlds. These are not personal concepts that people have an emotional reaction to, other than maybe, wow, right? Here, we're showing something much more intimate, much more human, much more emotional. We are talking about life and death and suffering, as well as success, victory, if you will. The emotions of finally being able to go home, mm-hmm. having survived, survivor's guilt, because maybe you survived it, the rest of your crew did not. So you see a lot more emotion, emotional reaction of our visitors, even among kids. Because when mom and dad start to cry, the kids might too. And it's not that we're a sad museum. I don't want to the message across to your listeners that come to our museum and you're going to go home a mess. Not at all. It's just that our museum has a much more intimate, much more human. We are much more about the human story of the 390th than bombs and bullets and radial engines and propellers and so forth. Our mission is to remember, to honor the courage and sacrifice and the success of everyone who served in the 390th. That's what we're about. We're about the people of the 390th in this period, this unique period of world history, and what they did, what they accomplished, what they went through, their homecomings, how they went on to build a successful country afterwards, to build functioning families and put their create kids and put their kids through school and to live to retirement and such. That's what we're about. We're not about the technology. Yes, we show the technology because these were tools, from airplanes to throat microphones used to communicate, or flare guns to communicate between planes, first aid kits, boots and gloves that kept them alive at 30,000 feet in the stratosphere. Yes, we present some of that technology, we showcase some of it, but it's ultimately about the human story.
The best museums, you know, as a plane geek, I've been to a few, and you tend to go and you look at the stuff and you have your favorites. And the thing I always say to people I'm with is it's an inanimate pile of steel and aluminum. Yep. It's not a thing until people get in it. And I think, you know, we've mentioned this many times, and I'm going to mention it again. The way the museum is here, you very quickly forget about the tech. You very quickly start thinking about the young men, and it's beautifully done. And I don't mean that in a manipulative sort of way. It's done right. And I think it's, you know, even for a lot of the exhibits around here as well, you're drawn away to the people stories, even though you're surrounded by a lot. But there, you have that sort of compression. You pop out from the entrance hall, you see the aircraft, and then very quickly you see the people.
Yes.
And it is something.
And in the coming months, you'll see a lot more people stories featured as we start setting up new exhibits that will feature, for example, exhibit that, cross our fingers, might come online tomorrow, is a complete set of flight clothing on a mannequin from literally the underwear on. They wore this blue-colored cotton underwear, blue bunny suit is what it became nicknamed as, but it's long johns, everything from ankle to wrist, piece of, wrapped in toaster wire. Toaster wire sewn into the fabric of this underwear, and then the leather-clad, sheepskin-lined, big, bulky flight suit, the gloves, the boots, the mask, helmet, the goggles, that'll be on a mannequin on display, like I said, hopefully tomorrow morning. It's scheduled to go into its case.
Oh, hopefully tomorrow's my last day. I want to see it.
I hope so. Don't make this legally binding, but the company that has the case that will get inserted into the wall is supposed to arrive 8:30 or so tomorrow morning. So if all goes according to plan, then at some point mid-morning perhaps, everything will be on display in there. So if you can come back for even just 5 minutes, it'll be worth your while. And we'll be filling the rest of those cases over the course of 2023 with a lot more personalized exhibits like that to tell. And boy, do I have plans for the upstairs and the other areas of the museum during the next 2-3 years.
Fantastic.
You won't recognize the place.
So there's one last question.
Yes.
And that is the Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks elephant in the room when it comes to talking about the 8th Air Force.
Yes.
Mass of the Air is due apparently later this year. You've got the book in there as well. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say what impact, it hasn't been out yet, but do you think that sort of show focusing on the Bloody 100th as well, do you think that might have the Band of Brothers effect where it starts focusing a lot into one specific group because people can recognize that? Sure. Or do you think it might have the broader effect of once again bringing the 8th to a new audience like, say, Memphis Belle did in the 90s?
I'm really hoping that it will ultimately inspire people to learn the broader story. Masters of the Air will have a Band of Brothers / Saving Private Ryan / Memphis Belle effects on the public imagination and public, pique the curiosity and interest among a large segment of the population to learn more about the air war in Europe. You know, the 100th Bomb Group is the focus of Masters of the Air, but never did the 100th Bomb Group fly without the 390th being alongside them and the 95th. Our three bomb groups always flew their missions together. The three groups were organized as the 13th Combat Wing. So the 100th never went where the 390th didn't go. So we were always there alongside, heading to the same targets. They had their own base, 95th Bomb Group, 390th, three different bases. We formed up together over England and went into experience the hell of air combat over Europe together. So the stories that you will see played out in Masters of the Air on, I believe, Apple Plus TV later this year are the same stories as the guys' experience of the 390th and the 95th, and for that matter, all the other bomb groups. The names might be different, but the experiences were essentially the same. The horrors, as well as the exhilarations. You've been given this, you're a pilot, you've just been promoted to pilot of a $250,000 piece of government machinery here. You have your cool leather jacket. You are in charge of these other nine guys. Sure, they had exhilaration and pride and all sorts of other positive emotions that I hope will also shine through in the television series. And we intend to also display more and more of that
in our exhibits.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for spending a bit of time with me. And it's a really, really moving museum.
Thank you so much. I couldn't agree more. Before I was hired here, even while working at the observatory, the 390th Memorial Museum and Pima Air and Space Museum were, as my wife knows, the place I spent all my free time. So when the opportunity to join the 390th team came along, oh my gosh, I couldn't write that application letter fast enough because I grew up with this as a family story. I started building B-17 models when I was 7 or 8 years old, on through high school. So this was a story that I was meant to help tell and propagate in my role.
Fantastic. Thank you.
I can't thank Bill Buckingham enough for his time and clearly his passion for the 390th Memorial Museum. I'm not blowing smoke at you, dear listener, to say that it is a very moving place. That wall of pictures, seeing all the jackets and knowing just how young the boys were that were wearing them. They're also very small as well. Even 6 months on, I'm still moved by the effect that the museum has. And if you're ever out there, as always, go visit our wonderful sponsors at the Pima Air and Space Museum. But do not miss the 390th Memorial Museum. And if you're there on a Thursday, there'll be a gentleman by the name of Dick Bouchon sitting in a fabulous A2 underneath the B-17. And he'll answer any question you have for him. Just about. Actually, I'm pretty sure he would answer any question you asked him. But Dick is 100 years young. He flew 28 missions with the 390th. And he is our guest next week. And he's just fantastic. I cannot wait for you to hear that. In the meantime, thank you so much for your continued support of the pod. As always, tell your friends, share the links. Let everybody know about this fantastic aviation history podcast and the wonderful 390th Memorial Museum that is on the top of your bucket list. Well, right after Pima, of course. If you fancy getting a bit more involved, as always, as a patron, you can become a Damcasteer from just £3 a month plus a bit of VAT. You get these episodes early, different intro extras, no ads, all of that good stuff, plus some bits and pieces that I've had in the works. Now that I've moved house, I might actually get around to them. You never know. But times are tough. I understand that. Just tell your friends, pop some stars into your app of choice. Because as we've been off for a couple of weeks, as I've been moving house, the downloads have continued. The reviews have still been coming in. You are all being incredibly generous with your praise. I can't thank you enough. And to reward you, next week you get to meet Dick Bouchon, who is, oh, he's just fabulous. Until then, do take care of yourselves. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.